great economist John Maynard Keynes once wrote of the foolish things a man thinking alone can come temporarily to believe. Fortunately, I did not have to think alone.
And neither do we. Welcome to Ceteris Never Paribus, the History of Economic Thought podcast, where all other things are never equal.
Welcome, everyone, to a new episode of Ceteris Never Paribus. Today, we're going to talk about James Buchanan, an American economist who was born in 1919 and was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1986 for his constitutional approach to economic theory. He's also known for his early work in public finance and his pioneering role in the field of public choice, that is the application of economic theory to the domain of politics. Jim Buchanan died in 2013, and today we're going to talk about his archives as well as his work with two people who recently published a volume that collects some of the archival materials of Jim Buchanan in a book called The Soul of Classical Political Economy. They are both with me here today, Alain Marciano and Pete Betke. Welcome, Alain.
Welcome. Thank you, Erwin, for allowing to be there.
Yeah. Welcome, Pete.
Thanks a lot for having us on, Erwin. It's a great pleasure to be here with you.
Yeah. So you've edited a book called The Soul of Political Economy, and it collects essays by Jim Buchanan from his archives, as well as extensive introductory essays by both of you about the main topics addressed in the book. So this is all based on the archives of Jim Buchanan, and they are located, Pete, I believe, at George Mason University.
Yep.
Can you tell us a little bit about the current state of the archives? And of course, the listeners truly want to know, how did you sneak in?
Well, we didn't sneak in. But Alain and Steve Medema and David Levy and some others know this history even better than me, because Buchanan, when they established the Buchanan House, which was shortly after he won the Nobel Prize, they established on campus. It was the former president's, residency there, and had an old building. They converted it into the Buchanan House. It was a working office. It wasn't an archive. It was set up as a working office. But obviously, Buchanan is a Nobel laureate, so they're going to try to keep and maintain his papers. And so they started to organize, in quotes, the papers. And this started with his longtime secretary, Betty Tillman, and then Joanne worked there. And then she was in charge of a lot. She started by working with the Buchanan Collected Works. So she was the organizer for the editors for the Collected Works. And then she, after the Collected Works project was over, she continued on with the archives. But Alain can tell you is that all of that was in Joanne's head. And you know, you would show up and she would say, I want to study this period. She'd say, well, maybe in that filing cabinet, in that closet over there, down in, you know, whatever. But they had signed an agreement that once Buchanan's the house stopped working, that they would turn it into a professional archive. This is an important little fact to know, is that it was already established that they were going to establish a professional archive. The question was whether or not they were going to do it digitized or in the traditional way. And that's a function of money, right? That's a function of money. So they did actually digitize around the Alain might know this better than I do, but I think it was around the 50th anniversary of the Calculus of Consent. They had digitized all of the documents around the Calculus of Consent. The university established, did a video about daring to be different. They released some of those data, that, you know, stuff, but that was just as a teaser. But then, you know, Buchanan was still working. All right, this is the thing that people have to remember. His office never stopped working. So as soon as he passed away, you now had his home in Blacksburg. You had his home in Fairfax, and you had the Buchanan House. All had to bring all of those files to the Buchanan House. And that's what happened in the summer as his estate was settled, you know, down in Blacksburg. And I was the faculty liaison that had to sit there with the graduate students taking the boxes, you know, off of the truck and putting them, stacking them up in the Buchanan House. In the fall of that year was when we had the memorial service for Buchanan. And January of that year was when they started the process. And we were very fortunate. We had a graduate student who then became a postgraduate student, Solomon Stein, who was really knowledgeable about Buchanan, but also deeply interested in archives. And so he helped as the day-to-day liaison with the library staff. And the only people who had access to the papers during that period of time, after it was officially announced that it was going to be archived in a professional way, were Alon and myself and Solomon. And the reason why Alon and myself had it was, one, that prior to the shifting over the archives, Alon and I already had agreed that we were going to try to put together a companion volume of various different pieces from the Buchanan archive. Was the documents and everything had to be eventually moved over there. It was about 2 years. Is that right, Alon, about professional processing where they had to actually try to, you know, make sure that mold didn't destroy the papers and all that kind of stuff like that. So, Alon, I'm sorry for talking so long, but yeah.
No, it's all right. I don't remember exactly the dates, but I think that the story is exactly this one. So in the first place, the papers in Buchanan House were in bad shape. There were papers all over the place. So it was very difficult to organize all that. And Solomon did a really great job. And the people from the library also did a great job because they put all that in folders and they organized that in boxes. Now it's much more clean than it was at the beginning. So now there is a record of everything. I think that they are in the process of digitalizing the entire archive, if I'm not wrong. So it was fascinating to see the all that unfolding before our eyes.
The original idea, which of course funding derailed, was that we were going to try to create a much larger archive. Made up of Buchanan's, also his students. Think about some of his. So we have at the center already. They already have the papers of Otto Davis. All right. So he was one of the forerunners. He was a PhD student of Buchanan. He went and worked at Carnegie Mellon. He was a developer of a mathematical approach to political science. Charlie Plott, who is a forerunner in experimental economics, and you know, these are all people that Mark Pauly's a forerunner in health and economics and stuff. And so the idea was to create this bigger archive, you know, that's all associated with Virginia School political economy kind of idea. But the for a variety of reasons, the kind of funding base for that didn't materialize. I mean, I was on the, did a little bit of like those kind of talks and, you know, chicken dinner talks and whatnot. But it just didn't materialize. But Buchanan's archives are there. The librarians that are involved, the dean of the library, which is John Zanellis and Lynn Eaton, they were able to get a National Endowment of Humanities grant to help with this final digitization kind of push. And so now the papers are all in the special collection wing of the Fenwick Library at Mason. They have a finding aid. So you can do a finding aid. It's just like visiting any other professional archive, like at the LSE or something like that. But unfortunately, all that happened right at the time that COVID then hit, which meant that the library was shut down. But what we're hoping to do with the volume is give a little taste to people about the importance or centrality of Buchanan for the recreation of political economy in the 20th century, and that he is a window into this vast literature because of his centrality in all these debates that maybe we can talk about. But he kept the one last thing I want to say about him, which I think is an important detail on archiving, is one, he himself was a pack rat. And he had a sense of himself from the very early part of his career. So just think about how many times you've purged all your files and stuff like that. He didn't do that kind of thing. All right. So that's one thing. So one thing. The second thing is that despite the fact that he moved from University of Tennessee to Florida State, Florida State to University of Virginia, University of Virginia to UCLA, UCLA to VPI, VPI to GMU, we don't have as much lost material as you might expect, because there was continuity in his main organizer of his activities, which is Betty Tillman. Very big record that covers his life from, you know, very thoroughly from the 1940s into the 2000 teens, you know, very thorough discussion of it. And it includes, you know, referee reports, on his papers, drafts of his papers, correspondence, because a large part of his career was before email. So I don't think we've been able to access the email files, which I think is going to be a huge issue for people in archives in the future.
Yeah, no, those are wonderful full insights, also because the past couple of years I've spent working in an archive that has none of these features. So I know some of the digging and the also the sort of on the fly archiving that you have to do yourself in order to keep some sense of orientation within the archive if that's not done. But it's wonderful to hear that that's now all there and also easily available, because it's incredibly time consuming, and also wonderful to hear that it's so inclusive, right? And it's not merely draft papers or anything of the sort, or only correspondence, but really everything he kept. So for those unfamiliar with Buchanan, Alain, would you mind being his intellectual biographer, just highlighting a few of the central themes in his work or the central approach to it?
Well, yes, it's at the same time, it's very easy and it's very difficult. So basically, he was a public finance economist. So it's true, it was true at the beginning, it remained true for a long time, but for him to be a public finance economist, eventually, at the end of the 50s, meant to be a public choice economist. So, and it meant to study rules. So one of the main central elements in Buchanan's thought was the importance of rules of the game. So if we want to play a social game, that is, if for any kind of human activity, we need to have rules to play the game. So it was something that came to him from Knight and also Simons. So I think that we should emphasize that Henry Simons also played a role in the formative years of Buchanan when he was at Chicago in 1946. So they didn't meet for a long time, but Buchanan was influenced by Simons as well as by Knight. And one of these influences was about this stuff, about the need of rules of the game. So, and then another important point is the role of ethics. I mean, a lot of people think that Buchanan was a pro-market, liberal economist, but I think he was an economist who believed that ethical rules are important to frame market activities. So market activities have to be framed by legal rules or constitutional rules, but also by ethical rules. So it was very favorable to a kind of redistribution of money. In his early years, he wrote about the need to redistribute money from rich states in a federal country to poor states. And I think it's also important to understand, to see that Buchanan was, and this is what makes him a political economist. So maybe it's the importance of the rules of the game, the importance of ethical rules. This is political economy in the sense of classical political economy. So what makes human beings is the fact that we exchange goods. So the importance of exchange that comes to him from Smith, the importance of exchange and the need to devise rules and institutions to organize this exchange, this is what makes human beings. And therefore, economists have to study how people devise rules to frame their activities. And this is where we have this connection between public finance and public choice, because public finance is about intervention of the state in the economy, taxes and expenditures. So political economy is exchange, rules, ethics to frame human activities and to frame the intervention of the government. And just if I may add another one, something which is also important is that just like in Samuelson's work, for instance, it was not a kind of opposition between the state and the market. It was the idea that between the two, there are the communities and the groups, not to say the clubs, but that people can build to organize the collective activity.
And in some extent, the state is even an extension of that self-organization in a way in his work, right?
Well, yes, in the sense that the state is a consequence of, the result of a social contract. So he believed in the need for a social contract between individuals.
Yeah. Okay, thanks very much. I want to return to the ideas in a moment, but I found one of the most interesting aspects of the book was actually a set of documents that you collect that show Buchanan in institution building action. So as a kind of academic entrepreneur involved with an attempt to create the Thomas Jefferson Center. Pete, in his introduction also about his journey through various universities, also already touched upon the fact that Buchanan was very often engaged in sort of organizing intellectual centers, trying to get them off the ground. And this particular document has him talking to I think the dean of the University of Virginia at the time, and he stresses the Virginia School of Political Economy that he sets out to do. And he also says this institution must dare to be different in the sense that it has to develop its own identity, right? We could be the 15th or the 25th school in America doing the same thing, but we should not attempt to do anything of the sort. But we have to recognize our identity. And then quite strikingly, he says, this university is both all of these Southern, Virginian, and Jeffersonian. Could you tell us a little bit about these aspects and this academic entrepreneurship? Because I know in some sense you also define quite deeply with Buchanan the academic entrepreneur.
I think it's great that Alon and I have those documents in here, and it gives a little sense of it, but not obviously the full rich story of it. I do recommend the book by Sandra Pert and David Levy on the Virginia School, and towards I think it relates to what Alon was just talking about describing Buchanan, that the title of their book is Towards an Economics of Natural Equals. When he was at the University of Chicago getting his PhD, he had Frank Knight. This had a huge impact on him in terms of his attitude about things. And one of his classmates was a guy named G. Warren Nutter. And he and Nutter had a conversation that Buchanan and Nutter have retold about, something's going wrong with economics, because economics isn't what it used to be. It's different. It's metamorphosizing into something different. It's going to be, as Buchanan would later stress, it's moving from a tool of social understanding to a tool of social control. And the vehicle by which it's doing that is the utilitarians, the engineers, and the elitists. Okay. And so this is what's going on. So we're going to have these utilitarians that are going to form a stable social welfare function. They're going to know how to maximize it, and they're trained to maximize it at elite institutions. And what Buchanan thought about that was that that was fundamentally non-democratic. It gives the economists too weird of a role in a democratic society. So he and Nutter said that if they ever, you know, found themselves at a place together, that they would develop a center to try to do this. And so they go off in their own ways, Nutter to Yale, and Buchanan to University of Tennessee, and then Florida State. Buchanan is particularly successful in those 10 years after graduate school, publishing many papers in top journals. And in the mid-1950s, 1956, they get a chance to go to University of Virginia. And Buchanan goes there, and then Nutter is hired as well. And so they decide that they're going to go and try to build something unique and special, harking back. And it's very Knightian. Now, why do I mention this Knightian thing? Is that when Nutter is recruiting Coase, he points out that there's this collection of economists, himself, Buchanan, and a guy named Routledge Vining, who are at UVA, who are all students of Knight. And as he puts it, Nutter to Coase, we've all learned our lessons in Knight well, and that we have a chance to do something unique here. And so the original name of the Thomas Jefferson Center was the Thomas Jefferson Center for Studies in Political Economy and Social Philosophy, which goes back to what Alain was just talking about. And to me, I think that when he was at UVA, that was when he was the happiest in his environment. He liked being at UVA. It's an elite school in the South, but it's not an elite school compared to Harvard, Yale, whatever. And that's what he's talking about, which he's trying to nudge, you know, his colleagues by saying UVA doesn't, you know, the reason why Dare to Be Different is UVA doesn't automatically put us in the elite, but it also doesn't automatically put us in the backwater. It's up to us whether or not we are viewed as elite or whether or not we're viewed as the backwater. But he gets derailed, and he gets derailed not with inside of economics, but outside of economics by other people that view Buchanan as ideological because he was doing this political economy and social philosophy thing. So then when he recamps at VPI, they focus almost exclusively on like the economics. This is when the public choice revolution really drills down and focuses on that. And then what happened was when that fell apart, that was because internal squabbles within economics about methodology. So he's defeated at some level ideologically at UVA, and then he's pushed aside methodologically at VPI. I should point out that in both instances, Buchanan could have survived. Every single school wanted Buchanan to stay, but they didn't want his center to stay as such. And so as a result, he decamps because he wants his center to go with him. And so when he comes to George Mason, which is his last, you know, place, and he helps build the program here. In fact, he is the reason why the program was built up. You know, it's very important for him to protect space for those who are liberal, even though Alam was right that Buchanan is more than just a liberal economist. He's a scientist in a sense, trying to study the interaction effect between rules and the exchange relationships that take place within rules. But methodologically and ideologically, he kind of creates a space because his two previous efforts had been derailed by one or the other. And I think that explains a lot of the way that he did things and who he chose to work with and how he develops all of those ideas in trying to advance this program that's Knightian in spirit, Vixellian in spirit, and grounded in this real politique of the Italian public finance guys. He starts by creating space for other academics and academics across disciplines, but he right from the beginning recognized the importance for training graduate students, because his argument is that none of the graduate students that are currently being trained have any skill in classical political economy kind of research questions. And in fact, it's being trained out of them.
2 points that Pete mentioned that are very important. One is the, so I'm going to start with the last one, training students. So one of the problems that Buchanan saw in the, and that led him and Nutter and Winning too to create the Thomas Jefferson Center, was that students were not trained, as Pete said, were no longer trained properly in political economy. And one aspect is that students and economists in general at that time were focusing too much on mathematics. They were forgetting economics. So they were putting the mathematical reasoning in the first place and forgetting the economic reasoning. So they wanted to, so this is the famous sentence, they wanted to save the books, but this is the idea that they wanted to lead students to read again books. The classics, of course, but to read important books and to read something that that words in it, not only models, not only axiomatic work. It's not that he was opposed to that, but he believed, he and Nutter believed that this is something that is in the piece that you were mentioning, Erwin. And the second point I wanted to emphasize about this stuff on academic entrepreneurship, I think you're right. Yes, Buchanan was an academic entrepreneur in the sense that he tried to build centers in Virginia, at UVA, at VPI, so at GMU. Entrepreneurship may be misleading in the sense that it may give the feeling that it was trying to promote something. But actually what he wanted to do with these centers to build an environment in which he could find people, he could invite people, he could train students with whom they could work together. If you read the first reports of the Thomas Jefferson Center, what is striking is that, well, we don't really know what political economy is. What is political economy? Political economy is what all the people in the center are doing. Yeah. So we are building something. So this is why it was important for him to be an entrepreneur, not to promote only ideas or maybe an ideology, or but also to build groups. Well, it's not so surprising that he wrote something on clubs, because he was really interested in groups of people.
Right. He has these multiple windows through which you look at the world, and the, rather than one window, there's only one window, which is the right perspective. In fact, his whole point was that truth, judgments, and politics lead to tyranny.
You see some of it also reflected already in this document, is that he's looking for schools with an identity, right? So I think this also speaks to indeed what he hopes for academic conversation, right? Not that everybody's looking indeed through the same window, but that everybody is willing to develop a full perspective and is willing to engage with others. And for that, knowing where you're coming from is very important. Can I ask one sort of small social question about the centers? Because I interviewed Bob Sugden a while ago, and he spoke very warmly about, I think he referred to them as Buchanan's nephews or so. responded, but I also heard stuff about Buchanan's work ethic and a sort of sense that everybody had to be very productive in those centers. Do we know anything about the sense of what kind of club was it, Alain?
Well, as far as I know, yes, Buchanan worked a lot. So as far as I know, he worked 6.5 days a week, so something like that. It was very productive, but the to a certain extent it's a bit confusing to see that as work. So Pete said that when you started discussing with him, it was not about the injuries or about really personal stuff. When you look at his correspondence, it's striking because there is not much of personal stuff in the letters. So even with people he knew very well, so there is a long list of letters with his friends when he was at Chicago, Harry Jenkins, and there's almost nothing personal in the correspondence. It was always about work. So they were exchanging letters very, very regularly about the papers they were writing together. That they never finished the paper, but so the thing is that he had a work ethic. He wanted to. He worked a lot, but he worked again. It's part of this conversation. Yeah. In addition,
Earl, to I think these are really, really insightful observations. I think because I just come fresh off this biography project of Tinbergen, and then initially I started with this idea that okay, he has a personal life and then a work life, and so my task as a biographer is to say something about how the personal life impacted the professional life, right, or the other way around, but something like that. But I realized that this model completely fell apart quite quickly, and so I think in the end it's much more about these intellectuals expressing themselves through the work, right? And so mm-hmm. in some sense their personality is in the work. So if you want to say something about them as persons, you sort of have to get very deep into the work, and then you see these aspects that also say something about them as a person. But to think that there's a separate individual outside there who is sort of separate from this work, I realize is not really the right way to think about this whole interaction.
I think also it's a matter of modesty. I see that as a matter of modesty. Maybe I'm wrong, but Buchanan, I think that Buchanan was, some people would do not know him very well, so think that it was not the case, but I think he was very humble and very modest, and they didn't always wanted to learn. I think that this work ethic is also a matter of modesty and humility.
All I wanted to say was I've had the very good fortune in my career to have bumped into, worked with, and been taught by three outstanding academic entrepreneurs who all share a similar concept about the way you do things. And that is Buchanan, Vernon Smith, and Eleanor Ostrom. And one of the common characteristics among all three of them is that they were lifelong learners. So when you went to have lunch with them, or you went and had a casual conversation with them, the conversation very rarely was about whether or not, you know, the Washington football team did well, or, you know, how's everything. They could talk about those things. Buchanan loved baseball. You could talk to him about the Cubs or whatever. But the main thing was, is that they were always about ideas. So in Buchanan's case, he always read the Times Literary Supplement, right? So he read that faithfully, and you would show up and he'd want to talk to you about what he had just read in the Times Literary Supplement. And they wanted to be part of an interesting and engaging conversation. They didn't want to be building where they were the smartest person in the room kind of thing. They wanted to be in a building where they were one among others that were all having this conversation. So this is what I think Sugden was getting at. That, you know, they all were part of the team. They were all working with him. They were all within his, you know, his orbit. But he just worked and worked and worked. So they felt that they had to keep working because he was willing to put in that time. And that's why they were so productive. That's what you see in those annual reports that Alain was talking about.
Alain, I want to go back to sort of the start of Buchanan's career, right? And at the start, he engages with both a Swedish and an Italian public finance tradition. And I think to some extent, these are traditions that are not very prominent in the history of economic thought. And in some sense, to me, they always even feel like they are somewhat at odds with the way that modern economics or even traditional political economies look like. In Dutch, there's a word called staatshuishoudkunde, which translates into state household art. So the art of state householding. And this is still what the National Association of Economists is called like. And it reminded me of that in some ways. But can you tell us a little bit about this tradition of public finance and what its origins are, and perhaps how it relates to something that in German they call Staatswissenschaften, or the sciences of the state? Because it seems to be different from what we know of as economics.
It's very close to political economy, to the political economy we were talking about earlier. This, we have to think about the philosophical foundations of the action of the state, we cannot analyze the role of the state only by analyzing one side of the government activity, expenditures or taxes. So you have to analyze both sides of the government budget together. You have to have to think about the philosophical foundations of the state before you want to analyze the behavior of the state. So the idea that you have to decide whether or not you are a collectivist or an individualist, then to analyze the behavior of the state. And also there is something which is, I think, important, is the notion of collective action, which is probably very important in the work of Wicksell and the work of the Italians Buchanan was interested in. The idea that the economy, and again, we talked about earlier, the idea that the economy, the society, and the state is itself the product of collective action. So human beings decide collectively what they want to do, and then they organize the state, or they organize, or rather, the state is the instrument that allows human beings, individuals, to implement this collective action. And I think that this is very different from the neoclassical economics. The Italians and Wicksell were also social philosophers. They were not only public finance economists. There were public finance economists who analyzed public finance in the sense that they analyzed the role of the state in a broad framework.
Yeah, thanks. So, and then there is a moment at which, right, because his initial work is really about financing the roads to make it practical. And then there is a transformation or an expansion, perhaps, of the research program, at which point it comes to be called public choice. Is there a specific moment that we can link to it, or a specific insight, something that a light bulb that goes off for Buchanan to think, well, we can make this into a more general point about the position and the role of the state in modern society?
Well, yes, I think that there is the change took place in something like 1958, I would say, probably around that date. So I think that there are two elements that are important in that. So Buchanan was interested in public finance. And then first he met Winning, and so he realized that rules are important. So this is what Buchanan said in his biography. And so he met Winning, and Winning was defending the idea that human society is about rules. Political economy is about collective action, and political economy is about collective actions and the rules that allow this collective action. And then he met Tulloch at about the same time, maybe 1 year later or something like that. And then Tulloch was a political scientist or an economist interested in political science. And he was interested in also in rules and political phenomena. And so all that was, and it relates also to Samuelson, because it was the time when Samuelson was starting to say, well, when there are market failures, the state needs to step in and to take over, because individuals are self-interested and they free right. So, and Buchanan was interested in understanding how the collective decisions could be made without being imposed by the state. And if you want to know how collective decisions can be made, you have to find a way to explain with quote marks, to explain how individuals choose the rules, which are the best rules that individuals can choose to make these collective decisions. And this is when Buchanan made this very slight move, because for him, it was still public finance. But it's a landslide, because it created public choice. And for him, it was still public finance, but it was a new form of public finance, a form of public finance in which you no longer study how individuals react to the decisions that have been made by the state, but it's a form of public finance in which you study how individuals choose the rules that lead to tax rates and the amount of public spendings and this kind of stuff. So it's this moment, probably in 1958, somewhere in 1958, that Buchanan changed, well, actually didn't change, because for him it was still public finance. But it was when public finance became public choice.
If I could say something real quick, I think that Alon's story is right. There's a historical aspect of this, which is that they originally called themselves non-market decision making. So could they take the tools of economic reasoning and look at the formation of rules? And the reason why Buchanan was so interested in that is that, and you can see this in the demand and supply of public goods in the beginning of that book, which was published in the mid 60s, he has a line in there where he says that we're striving to get a genuine institutional economics. And that actually is something Knight was very interested in going back to the 1940s and earlier, as Ross Emmett has highlighted. And what Buchanan says is that a genuine institutional economics not only analyzes the behavior within institutions, but uses the tools of economic reasoning to construct the very rules under which we interact as well. And that's what a genuine, so it's this interaction. And given your own interest, Erwin, and our interest in general, if you think about the old divide from Weber to Schumpeter to Knight, what you have is economic theory, and then you have economic history, and then in the middle is this thing called economic sociology, right? That people came. But if you look at the way in which Weber defined that, or the way Knight defined that, it's examining the social, political, and legal interactions with the economics, right, or the agents. And so Buchanan was finding that space again, I think, of political economy.
There's lots I want to expand upon. One, but I'll highlight one thing, I think, in the way you tell the story, right, is that public choice is ultimately about the choice of rules or institutions that we live together by. And so there's this funny historical accident that public choice gets introduced in the Netherlands by a Timbergen student, right? And in some sense, that doesn't make any sense, because you think, well, you know, Timbergen, self-interested politicians and experts, that's not really his cup of tea. But he was very much aware of this choice of institutions. And yeah, he particularly was critical of the nation state and the effect of the nation state in Europe, and he didn't want people to take that the nation state as the natural unit as a given. So he was constantly pushing for no, we can choose other institutions by which we govern ourselves, or that govern us. I think that would be more his phrasing. But from that perspective, right, that makes a lot of sense, because that's precisely the type of question that he would ask compared to the other one that we also associate with public choice, which is simply the sort of using rational choice theory to study the behavior of politicians, right? Alain, I want to ask one question that perhaps is very European, so we'll alienate Pete from this conversation. But right, Buchanan around this time starts referring back to Jefferson a lot, and he starts using the word constitution very, very often, right? So he also appeals in some sense to an American heritage or an American tradition in which the rules were truly made, right? So that the American experiment allows you to choose your rules again, or perhaps to draw up a new constitution, or to have a new constitutional moment. How do you look at this as somebody who comes from France and a quite different political tradition? And do you think that in that sense that makes Buchanan a typical American thinker, or would you frame that differently?
Social life and the human societies is very different from the kind of approach we have in France. Well, at least from the kind of approach, the kind of vision of the state we have in France, which is a very centralized state and For me, it's a kind of universal way of envisaging human societies, in the sense that it's very close to people like you, more people like Smith, who are Europeans. And also, it was very close to Wicksell's ideas and the Italians. So the idea that we start from small communities, small groups of people, friends and acquaintances, and then we develop interactions with neighbors and people who are farther. So the only difference with the tradition that we have in France, which is very centralized maybe, and in which state is supposed to be strong, and the state in which we, a situation, a society in which we are very reluctant. Now it's changing because of the pandemic, but the people were very reluctant to decentralize, and they were opposed to federalism. In that sense, it's very different from Buchanan's thought, because Buchanan was very much of a federalist, so he was opposed to centralization. He was aware that a federal country had to face very specific problems.
That it's important to keep in mind that Buchanan, in some fundamental sense, is actually very, he wouldn't put it this way, but he's very impacted by a puzzle from Rousseau, which is, how can a man be free while subject to wills other than their own? And so the seeking is, we must choose in groups. There's no escaping the choosing in groups. And even in that 1949 paper, one of his main things is he points out that John Baptiste de Say is not right to talk about the state as only a parasitic function, that actually the state is beneficial. So he right from the beginning, he's saying there's benefits as well as costs. But the way we can understand those benefit cost calculations is going to be a function of the rules under which we operate in choosing in groups.
I want to move to Buchanan and his relation to some other schools of thought to which he draws our attention. We've already mentioned two, right? Wicksell in Sweden, as well as the Italian public finance. But the book also contains two essays on two other traditions from the 20th century. One is the LSE oral tradition, which to me was even more fascinating because, of course, as a historian, you also wonder to some extent how you best tell the stories of intellectual communities, right? And of course, these can be told through the published papers and the ideas that sort of filter through history. But Buchanan here tells a quite different story about the LSE and the oral tradition. Alain, do you want to elaborate a bit on what this LSE oral tradition for him is, and what he means by it, or how did he even learn about it, perhaps?
Buchanan learned about the LSE because he went there in the early 60s. So Buchanan traveled a lot. So and in the early 60s, he went to the LSE and he made acquaintance of people there. He also learned about the LSE because Coase was at UVA at the end of the 1950s. So Buchanan learned about the... So as Pete mentioned in the introduction, there are a lot of letters. There are a lot of the huge amount of letters and correspondence in the archives. So it's written, it's not oral, but there are some elements in these letters that show that Buchanan was listening to people. So and something which is surprising, for instance, is that there is almost nothing, almost no letters from Coase in this archive. So there are letters between Buchanan and Coase elsewhere. At Chicago in the Coase papers, but almost nothing about Coase as far as I remember. So, which is not surprising because there were 2 meters away, the offices were 2 meters away. So it makes sense. But it means also that they were talking a lot. So I think that Buchanan learned from the LSE from Coase. He learned from the LSE when he went to to London on various fellowships and Fulbright. I think it was on the Fulbright at one point.
He was a Fulbright fellow both in Italy in the mid-50s. And then I think he's a Fulbright fellow in Cambridge and in LSE. He becomes friends with a guy named Jack Weissman, who's a radical subjectivist, a product of this environment as well. He reads Shackle. You know, he's reading all of these people. But you can find references as early in his writing as you can date to Mises and Hayek. And this gets forgotten a lot in the discussion. Mises' book, Human Action, is published in 1949. And Hayek's Individualism and Economic Order is in 1948. If you go and look at the old Chicago reading list that was required, Bombavrick's Capital and Interest, the smart version of that, is on the reading list. In fact, in Milton Friedman's Price Theory course with Jacob Viner in the 30s, there's more Bombavrick than there is actually Marshall in the way that he was teaching and stuff. And so these guys, they didn't see economics as divided by the Austrian school, the Swedish school, those are labels that come later. Right now, it's just good economics. Like, this is what you do to know economics. You need to know these kind of ideas. And in that mix is all these ideas about the subjectivity. I mean, how could we characterize the complex adaptation of individuals and engage in exchange behavior? And he had all kinds of weird things. I mean, he told us to read this, you know, the Woolly Masters or whatever, you know, about, you know, the Tao of Physics, constantly grappling after how do I study people and their exchange behavior and the institutions within which exchange behavior takes place. And hopefully what Alon and I are doing is giving people a window into not only the richness of the archives, but the richness of this alternative vision of public choice and constitutional political economy, which Buchanan stood for.
Yeah, to me, that's also one of the fascinating aspects in some sense is where Buchanan's legacy is going to find homes, right? Because clearly there's now a new movement toward PPE where he is a thinker that's well studied, but there's a sense in which he wanted to have conversations with Rawls, right? Yeah. So he could become part of political philosophy. There's a sense in which he wanted to have conversations with Chicago economics or Samuelson, as you mentioned, right? So he could have a place there as a constant critic of what at some point was mainstream economics. There's a sense perhaps in which he himself envisioned yet another program which isn't fully realized. Right, so that might be one of the fascinating aspects where all of that is going to find a home, and hopefully the archives will be helpful with that. Alain, I want to ask you one final question, because Pete at the very beginning mentioned that Buchanan was quite aware of himself, right, and that he kept notes, that he kept his own, even his class notes from being in the lecture hall with Frank Knight and thinking, well, at some point these notes might be of relevance either to me or to somebody else wishing to study me. How do you navigate this this aspect as a historian of him having written quite a bit, including an autobiography about his own intellectual development, and now being in the archive and sort of seeing the other side of things as they unfolded?
Well, sometimes it's a bit strange because it's obviously, Buchanan reconstructed a little bit his own past. But I mean, it's not, probably the past was not, it's not that it misrepresented it, but it's that just he simplified what happened to make things more visible to the people to whom he was talking. For me, one of the interesting things is to try to figure out exactly, for instance, when he became really a Vixenian, because the story is that he was a Vixenian very early. Yes, he read Vixen very early, but actually he became Vixenian rather slowly. It's interesting as an historian because you have to understand, try to make fit the story that he told with the story that is can be found in the archives. And most of the time it fits. I mean, it's not that Buchanan was lying about himself. So most of the time it fits. And what is fascinating as an historian is when you find the letters and the papers that explain what he wrote. Another instance, if I may, there is in the foreword of the Public Principles of Public Debt, he explains something about Ricardian equivalence. So, and when you find in the archives the documents that allow you to substantiate the claim he made in the foreword of the book, this is something that you, as an historian, this is very rewarding. The kind of feeling that you have when you find the pieces of a jigsaw that you have tried to find for years, and then suddenly you find it. So this is what the looking in the archives, this is the kind of feeling that you have when you look in the archive. It's very, very rewarding, very interesting, because all the pieces of this big jigsaw that was Buchanan fit together.
Okay, wonderful. I mean, we couldn't have a better invitation for other people to go into that archive and figure out, find more pieces of the puzzle and put them together. That's really wonderful to hear. And so thanks again, Alain and Pete, for being part of Caetus Never Paribus. And hopefully many people will pick up the book, The Soul of Political Economy, and explore the work of Buchanan further. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Erwin. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode enough to come back for more. The featured music is called Knowing Nothing by Mid-Air Machine, and our intro features Paul Krugman at his Nobel Prize banquet speech in 2008. Thank you to Noble Media AB for giving us the permission to use the audio. Check out our website, CetrusNeverParibus.net, for more information. Follow us on Twitter, CetrusNParibus, and listen to more episodes on iTunes or your favorite podcast app.